Hello and welcome to the Theotivity Podcast. My name is Thaddeus. I'm glad that you've joined us for today's episode. Today we're going to be talking about a really important topic. We're going to give a little bit of an introduction to a Christian view of civil government, because I think this is a well-needed topic to be addressed today, as many Christians don't actually have a biblically informed view of what civil government should be. Many Christians today actually view politics as dirty and something secular which they should not involve themselves in, far less bring their faith into it. However, much of the decline of Western societies in recent years, I think, is due to the decreasing influence of Christian beliefs over our societies in all areas, including politics. If Jesus says that we're to be salt and light, an analogy which is speaking to our preserving and illuminating influence upon society, then it's reasonable, right, that in whatever spheres of Christian life that Christians retreat from, where the Christian influence is not there, that it will lead inevitably to decay and darkness in those spheres of life. So Christians shouldn't retreat from the political sphere any more than they should retreat from other spheres like education and business and the arts or any other area of public life. So we're going to be talking a little bit about this concept of a Christian view of civil government. Let's jump on in.
The Theotivity Podcast. Theotivity is the place where theology and creativity come together. Here you'll find audio narration of articles, episodes exploring the faith, culture, the arts and media, systematic theology, apologetics, guest interviews with Christian thinkers, creatives, pastors, theologians, and much more. At theotivity.com, you'll find articles and resources to help you grow in your faith, as well as a portfolio of creative works. Like, share, and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest content.
So, to begin with, I think there's a false sacred-secular divide within the minds of many Christians today, that there's this sacred realm and a secular realm, and the two don't ever interconnect or overlap, and that we should keep them separate. But there's always a God of whatever social order. If in that whatever social order it is, it's not the God of the Bible and His Word, which becomes the organizing principle for that society, then it's going to be some other false God. Furthermore, it's actually impossible for anyone in political office to be free of their own religious convictions, which will necessarily impact how they carry out their roles in government. Actually, as Dr. Joseph Boot notes, the operative presupposition of a separation of faith and government, of religion and the public space, is an impossible myth. It is a lie used to push the Christian faith out of sight and mind, replacing it with a new religious order. It's interesting that law professors Rex Adhar and Ian Lee, in a 2004 article for the McGill Law Journal entitled "Is Establishment Consistent with Religious Freedom?" They make it clear that there's no such thing as a religiously neutral state. Hear what they say, quote, "For a modern state to remain entirely impartial is, we submit, an impossible feat. The idea of a purely neutral state in which there is no official endorsement of the true and good of a political community that eschews the notion that it acts on the basis of substantive values is a mirage. The established position will inevitably exclude the worldview of some citizens." So therefore, the question is not, do religion and politics mix? Rather, it is this, which religion and politics will be mixed? How about the objection, hey, you can't legislate morality? Or can you? If you think about it, every civil law says, thou shalt not do this. And then it enforces it with the coercive power of the state and threatens punishments in terms of like fines or prison, etc., right? In effect, it's saying that this thing is morally wrong and deserves punishment. So you know, when we consider that, it's actually that you can only legislate morality. It's just a question of whose morality. The noted scholar of biblical law, R.G. Rusdoni, he says this, the fact is that all law is religious. All law is based on some ultimate standard of morality and ethics. Every system is founded on the ultimate value of that system, and the ultimate value is the God of that system. The source of law for society is the God of that society. So, show me the source of a society's laws, and I'll show you that society's God. You see, moral laws must have an objective reference point to be based upon so that they can be applied equally to all people. And if we were to appeal to, let's say, a populist basis and use polling statistics to determine right and wrong, then justice will always be held hostage by the 51%. If it is the Supreme Court, let's say, then that's also a changing standard. For example, in 1986, the US Supreme Court ruled to outlaw sodomy. But then in 2003, the court reversed the ruling and wiped out all anti-sodomy laws. So which court decision was actually right? And, you know, why is it in these sorts of subjective and changing standards, why not listen to someone like Adolf Hitler instead of Gandhi? By what standard are you going to make that decision? Every law must make an appeal to a higher source of authority. And when that is a human authority, it becomes subjective and variable, providing no steady source for morality. Only when laws are rooted in the authority of the immutable and unchanging God of the Bible do we have a sure foundation for law. Thus, it's only if they're fixed, there's like this fixed ethical absolute beyond and above the fallible decisions of judges and politicians that we can determine what is true and then hold men accountable to it. Erwin Lutzer, actually, in his book on what lessons we can learn as the church from Nazi Germany, really great book, it's called When a Nation Forgets God, he says this: when God is separated from government, we are forced to accept arbitrary laws. Either God is the lawgiver or man is. Either we derive our laws from theistic universal values, or we say that the individual countries or cultures are the lawgivers. Either God is supreme or the state is supreme. And this is actually was the issue, if you read the history of the Nuremberg trials, which happened after World War II, when the Nazis, they actually claimed that they did nothing wrong according to their own country's laws at that time. So how could they be prosecuted? So a supreme law in those Nuremberg trials had to be evoked that transcended even human courts and systems of law in order to convict the Nazis of any sort of criminal activity, really. Because according to their country's laws, it was fine. So if we want a truly just society and government, it must be according to God's righteous standards. As Christians, we should actually long for this. As C.H. Spurgeon once said, "I long for the day when the precepts of the Christian religion shall be the rule among all classes of men and all transactions." I often hear it said, "Do not bring religion into politics." This is precisely where it ought to be brought, and set there in the face of all men as on a candlestick. I would have the cabinet and members of parliament do the work of the nations as before the Lord. End quote. You know, there's also the objection that some people will bring of, but, you know, Dad, we're not under law, we're under grace, right? So the objection here is that since we're in the New Testament age, that we're no longer under the law, but we're under grace. Therefore, some Christians want to abolish the continuing validity of the Old Testament law. They want to unhinge it. However, this is not what the Bible teaches. You see, we're freed from the curse of the law, Galatians 3:13, but not from the guidance of the law. Paul says in Romans 3:31, that do we then nullify the law through faith? May it never be. On the contrary, we establish the law. So though we are saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ, he's our curse bearer and our law keeper on our behalf, the law still does show us what is good and what is God's will. It is a tool then for our sanctification as Christians, not for our salvation. It shows us what is pleasing to God. In fact, for the Christian, because God has changed their hearts so that they love his law, 1 John 5:3 says that, "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome." And Jesus himself says that, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments," John 14:15, right? Another objection is that, but we can't hold pagans to God's law, right? The objection basically is that using God's law as the standard for civil society is that, you know, we can't hold non-Christians to God's law because they don't believe in him or the Bible. However, God doesn't seem to think that way. God doesn't exempt other nations from the requirements of his righteousness. He holds them responsible for their sins. For example, see Amos 1, verses 3 to chapter 2, verse 5. He wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah for their sins. Those were pagan nations. He judges even pagan nations and uses them as his rod of his anger, as in the case of Assyria and the proud king Nebuchadnezzar, right? Nebuchadnezzar was a pagan king, and yet God judged him for his pride and humbled him, actually. In fact, Paul actually explicitly reaffirms this. He says in 1 Timothy 1, verses 8 and 9, he says, "Now we know that the law is good." See, he's affirming the goodness of the law. "If one uses it lawfully, understanding this," what do we need to understand? "That the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient." See, so even for non-Christians, the law is applicable. Now, the law is also a teacher. So again, the law can't save. We're not Pelagian legalists who think that the law brings salvation, but the law can and does teach people what is right and wrong. As Paul said, right, in Romans 3:20, "For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin." The law is needed to teach people what sin is and to prepare them for the gospel. This is exactly what Paul says in Galatians 3:24. He says, "So then, the law was our guardian or our teacher until Christ came, in order that we may be justified by faith." So therefore, God's law, applied in the public sphere, also helps to teach society at large what sin is and prepare people for reception of the gospel. Glenn Sunshine actually notes that, quote, "Legislation thus plays a major role in shaping public morality, a point recognized by the Puritans who established schools in New England so that people would know their Bible and hold their legislators accountable for the laws that they passed." Note here that it is Christians who must hold legislators accountable to God, for we are the ones who have an understanding of his law. Now, one of the reasons our societies have departed from God's standards is actually because Christians failed to keep doing this. Now let's talk a little bit about God's vision for society. We have to affirm also the goodness of God's law and his vision for how society should be run. And I think it's interesting to note that in Israel's political economy, ruled by God's law in the Old Testament, there were 365 laws about that, right? The Ten Commandments being the central law, right? And I would argue that the other laws actually expounded the implications of the Ten Commandments on every other sphere of life. Today, though, people look upon biblical law as oppressive. Yet our modern secular states have multiplied their laws in their books to the hundreds of thousands. You know, in the Old Testament, you had 365. Now in our modern states that have gone away from God's law, we have hundreds of thousands of laws. We live under so much more regulations and restrictions than what God has set up for his model of government in the Old Testament. You see, God's law truly is the perfect law of liberty, James 1:25. Now, for those who think that the Bible does not deal with politics and government, Dr. Kenneth Gentry, I think, actually offers a good introductory correction to this. He says this, quote, "That God is vitally concerned with political affairs is quite easy to demonstrate. It is God who ordained governments in the first place." See Romans 13:1, Romans 2:21. "He is the one who established particular kings." See Proverbs 16:12, Psalm 119:46, 47, 82, and verse 1 and 2. "Therefore, he commands our obedience to rulers," Romans 13, verses 1 to 3. "Rulers are commanded to rule on his terms," Psalm 2, verse 10. Even in the New Testament, activity of political import is discoverable. Jesus urged payment of taxes to the de facto government. See Matthew 22, verses 15 to 22. Right? In response to reminders of King Herod's political threats against him, Jesus publicly rebuked the king and called him a vixen. See Luke 12:32. He taught that a judge is unjust if he does not fear God. See Luke 18:2 and 6. John the Baptist openly criticized King Herod in Luke 3:19 and 20. Peter refused to obey authorities who commanded him to cease preaching. See Acts 5:29. So let's talk a little bit about Christianity and government. There was once a time when Christians understood the importance of God's law to civil government. In the UK, the oath required of Queen Elizabeth II, the head of the state of Great Britain and Canada, stated this, quote, "Will you, to the uttermost of your power, maintain the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel? Will you, to the uttermost of your power, maintain in the United Kingdom the Protestant Reformed religion established by law?" And after this quote, the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland actually brought to the Queen the Bible and exhorted her to its vital importance in her reign. He said this to her, "Our gracious Queen, to keep your majesty ever mindful of the law and the gospel of God as the rule for all, for the whole of life and government of the Christian princes, we present you with this book, the most valuable thing that this world affords. Here is wisdom. This is the royal law. These are the lively oracles of God." Wow. In the US, the president, when taking his oath of office, actually places his hand on an open Bible to Deuteronomy 28, invoking the blessings and curses of the law for obedience and disobedience. Almost all the modern Western societies that have enjoyed an extended season to this day of freedom and prosperity, formerly unknown to history, all of these societies were based on Judeo-Christian values derived from scriptures. And this is why in many of our legislature buildings, today even, Bible verses are literally carved into stone. Jonathan Burnside, professor at the School of Law at the University of Bristol, in his book, God, Justice, and Society, he notes this, quote, "Biblical law is also remarkable for its revolutionary breadth and depth of vision. It has the imaginative power to disturb the world. A great deal of modern law is an indirect engagement with biblical law. For example, the abolition of the English laws of blasphemy in 2008. But often, it is so implicit that we are not aware of it. We have taken our understanding of biblical law for granted for so long that it has become unfamiliar." End quote. God said actually to his old covenant people concerning his law, hear this. He said in Deuteronomy 4, verses 6 to 8, "Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all of these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today?" You see, for Israel in the Old Testament, other nations were to look to them and be amazed at them because of the beauty of God's design for their government, which brought his blessing and his prosperity to them. Indeed, even in our modern history, other countries looked to those who were at one time based their governmental systems on God's principles, such as the US and Canada. And therefore, these countries enjoyed much prosperity and freedom. You see, what was true of Old Testament Israel is actually true throughout time, that other nations look to nations that base their systems of government upon God's law, and they will remark and see, wow, look at this great nation. Look at its great statutes and rules. Yet for some reason, many Christians are either ignorant to this or actively oppose this concept in the name of this myth of neutrality. What most Western people, including Christians, are asking for in the name of freedom is in fact a new slavery when they attempt to secularize the public sphere and pursue freedom without the lordship of Christ. To object to this by saying that non-Christians are not accountable to God's covenant law or his moral law is finally to say that we have no basis for presenting the gospel to the unbeliever, since scripture defines sin as lawlessness. And only lawbreakers need the gospel. That was Dr. Joseph Boot from his book, Mission of God. You see, if men will not serve God, they'll become slaves of men. Dr. Greg Bahnsen, he said that, quote, "The civil magistrate cannot function without some ethical guidance, without some standard of good and evil. If that standard is not to be the revealed law of God, then what will it be? In some form or expression, it will have to be the law of man or men. The standard of self-law or autonomy. When autonomous laws come to govern a commonwealth, the sword is certainly wielded in vain, for it represents simply the brute force of some men's will against the will of other men." End quote. This is indeed what we've seen happening in our times all over the world. As societies drift further away from God's law as their standard of justice and guide for civil governance, we've seen global totalitarianism and lawlessness on the rise. We have to restore these foundations. So, what then is God's design for government? Let's talk about some types of government. Now, lest you think that I'm arguing for some sort of salvation through politics, let me clearly state I'm not. Okay? This is not an argument for salvation through politics. Humanists actually usually conceive of government as a top-down bureaucracy that controls almost everything in a society and thus can achieve societal or social order by centralized planning. However, the Bible teaches that government is actually a bottom-up appeals court structure that begins with self-government and family government, right, the two building blocks of society, and then emanates outwards to church government and then civil government. So the types of government that we see in the Bible is actually firstly self or and family government, right? So mothers and fathers have authority over their children. You see this in Proverbs 6, 20 and 21, Proverbs 15, 5 and 30, 17, also in Ephesians 6, 1 to 3 and Colossians 3, 20. Secondly, you have church government, where church leaders and elders and deacons hold authority in the church. We see this affirmed in Matthew 16, 19, and also in 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 and 13, and 1 Timothy 5:17, and Hebrews 13, and 1 Peter 5, right? We also, thirdly, have civil government, where civil rulers exercise political authority by God's decree. And you see this affirmed in Matthew 22, 21, Romans 13, 1 to 7, and 1 Peter 2, verses 13 to 14, and other places. This is God's design for civil society. It's of multiple decentralized, delegated and delineated authorities under his sovereign, unlimited authority. He's the only one with unlimited authority. Every other, for the society, it's going to be multiple decentralized, delegated and delineated authorities. This concept is actually known formally as sphere sovereignty. I'm going to talk a little bit about what exactly sphere sovereignty is. This term is actually, I think, originally coined by the Dutch statesman and theologian Abraham Kuyper. Now, this concept would need actually a lot more fleshing out in its details than I can get into here, but we're going to get into a little bit of an introduction. And I think Glenn Sunshine in his book, Slaying Leviathan, gives a good starting definition. He says this, quote, "Sphere sovereignty holds that society consists of a number of autonomous spheres that should properly regulate their own affairs. These include government, religion, family, education, business, labor, and others. Government in particular has a specific set of responsibilities related to defense against all enemies, foreign and domestic, the enforcement of laws, and seeing to it that the spheres neither overstep their bounds nor violate the law. Although each of these spheres should govern its own affairs, sometimes on a wide scale they do not. Family structures collapse, schools fail to teach effectively, businesses act unethically, labor organizations become corrupt. When this happens, the temptation is for another sphere, almost inevitably the government, to step in and fix the problem rather than to work to revitalize the failing spheres. Unfortunately, government is ill-equipped to solve these problems. Its tools and its competence lie in its areas of responsibility, not in those of other spheres." End quote. The reformational philosopher D.F.M. Strauss, he actually writes this, that the state does not grant existence to any non-state sphere sovereign social entity. It merely has to acknowledge that, on equal footing, there are multiple distinct and sphere sovereign social entities. And I think Dr. Joseph Boot, he's helpful in noting that the principle of sphere sovereignty thus enables us to distinguish a just state from an absolutist power state. Because a just state will recognize in terms of the Christian principle a variety of spheres of law within society, including public law, civil private law, and non-civil private law. So each of these spheres is independent and legitimately has God-given authority within its established boundaries. Although there may be some overlap of the spheres, so for example, a church building belongs to the sphere of a church, right? But it's also located within the geography of a state. No sphere, though, can consume another into itself and dictate in matters proper to the other sphere's jurisdiction. So, for example, the state cannot tell and should not tell the church what to preach. But where the spheres do touch, they can exercise influence on each other through dialogue, not through dictates. And that's one of the things that we've seen gone wrong for the past couple of years now, right? That these spheres, particularly the government, is dictating to other spheres that it does not have legitimate God-given jurisdiction in. For each of the major spheres, God has ordained, he has also given to its leaders of that sphere a legitimate tool to enforce their authority. So, for example, the family bears the rod of discipline, and the church bears the keys, which are the preaching of the word, administration of the sacraments, and church discipline. And the state bears the sword for administering criminal justice. When the spheres start to get mixed up, things go pretty awry. For example, when the state steps into the family sphere, right, its only tool is the sword, which is coercive, and you end up with forced public education and seizure of children from their homes, and also even maybe implementation of childbearing limits, as in China's one child policy at some time. Thus, for the Christian, when we're thinking about issues of government, we should ask this: what biblically is the proper sphere to which these various institutions belong? Right? So you should ask, okay, what is the proper sphere of education? What's the proper sphere of welfare, of protection of borders, of charity, of compassion ministry, etc., right? All of these spheres, these legitimate institutions and roles don't all fall under government. They actually fall more properly into other spheres such as the church, the family, etc., right? And one of the errors that leads to ever-increasing governments is that trend towards this totalitarian control is the relinquishing of these other institutions and spheres by default to the state, which does not have the right God-given tool to carry out these functions, because all the state has in terms of its tool given to it by God is the sword. The state's function then biblically, when we define it biblically, is actually very limited. Now let's talk a little bit about the concept of separation of powers, because this is really important to understand for a Christian understanding of government. Another feature of God's design is a system of separated and limited powers. Max Demont, he notes that in the Mosaic Code, the civil authority was independent of the priesthood. Though it is true that the priesthood had the right to settle cases not specifically covered by Mosaic law, see Deuteronomy 17:8-12, that did not place it above the civil government. The priesthood was charged with the responsibility of keeping this government within the framework of the Mosaic law, just as the United States Supreme Court is not above the federal government, but is nevertheless charged with the responsibility of keeping it within the framework of the Constitution. Dr. Guy DeMar, in his book, Restoring the Foundations of Civilization, I think he's very helpful here. He says this, quote, "In biblical terms, there was never such a jurisdictional separation between church and state that the state was free from God's law," see Deuteronomy 17:15-20. "Both priest and king were required to sit before the law and be instructed. The priest was to follow guidelines pertaining to ecclesiastical affairs, while the king would glean from scriptures those directives designed for his civil office. If a case was too difficult for the civil ruler to decide, the Bible gives the following instruction: you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case," in Deuteronomy 17:9. David accepted Nathan's rebuke. He didn't tell Nathan that there's a separation between church and state. Then David said to Nathan, "I've sinned against the Lord," see 2 Samuel 12:13. Modern-day separationists are closer to the way Herod responded when John the Baptist rebuked him for his adultery in Mark 6, verses 14-29. "What a ruler does privately is none of your business," he said, right, basically. Thus, we've seen in successful Western democracies, which were based on Judeo-Christian principles, broadly speaking, that there's a system of checks and balances through separate branches of government power. Namely, usually it's in these three: the judicial, which evaluates laws, the legislative, which makes the laws, and the executive branch, which carries out laws. Furthermore, the church and the state are not mixed. We must note, however, that there's a jurisdictional separation between church and state, but not a religious separation. It does not mean that the church cannot speak prophetically to the state and call them to God's righteous standards, only that the church cannot and should not carry out the state's rule. So, for example, the church can't execute people, right? Nor should the state carry out the church's rule. Each needs to stay in their lane. So this idea of separation of powers is very, very important, because in separating these powers out into different branches of government, in civil government, for example, you delimit and you put a restraint on the corruption that could happen in government because you have a system of checks and balances. Each branch is supposed to keep the other in check. Now let's talk about totalitarianism, right? Because what happens when these spheres don't actually stay in their lane, when they don't stay in their God-assigned jurisdictions? Usually what happens is a steady decline to some form of totalitarianism, since the state, which bears the most deadly tool, the sword, right, starts to step in and to consume the roles of the other spheres, treating them in a parts-to-whole fashion. You see, in totalitarian systems, the state treats all the other spheres of society as parts of the state. We see this especially in as societies turn increasingly secular and reject the God of the Bible. They end up instead deifying the state because that's the next most powerful thing. The German philosopher, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, he's actually shaped a lot of contemporary secular thought. He said this, quote, "The state incarnates the divine idea upon earth." Hegel saw the state as divinized, as God, right? In effect, he was saying that, right? And the Italian dictator, Benito Mussolini, he declared, "Everything for the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state." When society turns from God, it must look to man for salvation. And the state is really just collectivized man, deified in these situations. Dr. Boot actually notes this. He says in his book, Mission of God, quote, "Man needs order, certainty, and salvation. And where God's governance is denied, man will attempt to mimic it. Wherever man has sought an immanent, not transcendent source of power, a theology of state has developed and a new doctrine of God has been fleshed out." You see, just because man jettisons God doesn't mean that he no longer lives in, or believes in predestinating power. You see, instead now, there's man deified who must predestine history by the force of centralized planning according to his vision of utopia. It's a false kingdom of God, basically. This is why we see a trend towards global elites planning and to enact their vision upon society and upon the lesser public through global agendas and great resets. You see, there's really only three choices for political life: popular sovereignty, state sovereignty, or God's sovereignty. Every totalitarian dictatorship always seeks to persecute the church because the church is what stands between authoritarian states and God's freedom, because the Christian church hails no higher king but Christ, and therefore we're a threat to a totalitarian system. In Horowitz's Dark Agenda, he says this, that in Russia, Marx's disciples removed religious teaching from the schools, outlawed criticisms of atheists and agnostics, and burned 100,000 churches. When priests demanded freedom of religion, they were sentenced to death. Between 1917 and 1935, 130,000 Orthodox priests were arrested, and 95,000 of whom were executed by firing squad. Thus, it's the church is actually going to be the main target for every dictatorship. During the Nazi rise to power, right from the beginning, in Luther's book, When a Nation Forgets God, he says this, that right from the beginning, Hitler sought to marginalize the church to guarantee that no Christian influence would be allowed to inform government policy. Worship would have to be a private matter between a man and his God. At all costs, the official state policy would have to be based on humanistic principles to give Hitler the freedom to do what was quote-unquote best for Germany. He said that the churches must be forbidden from interfering with temporal matters. The state would have to be scrubbed clean of all Christian convictions and values. End quote. Hitler actually said to Christian pastors, "You confine yourselves to the church, I'll take care of the German people." And he remarked, "How fortunate for governments that the people they administer don't think." Now, regrettably, many churches during Hitler's rise to power accepted the argument that religion and morality should be separated from politics and based this on their claim of neutrality, right? But religion was a private matter. Historian Richard V. Pierrot, he actually writes this, that concerned itself with the personal moral development of the individual. The external order, nature, scientific knowledge, statecraft, operated on the basis of its own internal logic and discernible laws. The famous World War II historian William Schreyer actually noted this, that in between lay the majority of Protestants who seemed too timid to join either of the two warring groups, who sat on the fence and eventually, for the most part, landed in the arms of Hitler, accepting his authority to intervene in church affairs and obeying his commands without open protest. As Dr. Bunsen has warned, if we will not have inscripturated morality from God as our socio-political standard, we have no principle to protect us from those who wish to play God. You see, there's no neutrality in politics. Secularism is every bit as religious as Christianity and rabidly evangelistic in spreading its message and expanding its kingdom. Those who helped undermine the fabric of traditional Christian Europe created the frightful void that communism and socialism and later national socialism would fill. As the anti-Nazi writer Ernest Jünger wrote, he wrote that deserted altars are inhabited by demons. As William O'Neill wrote, in socialism, the state is deified. In libertarianism, the individual. In communism, the party. And in national socialism, the nation is deified. Only in a truly biblical situation, the state as well as the individual, the party as well as the nation, are directed towards God. We do not serve the state, but the state and we are to serve God. Thus, it is important that Christians and churches have a clear theological conviction of God's design for civil government and be engaged in civic life. We are the most important line of defense for freedom and flourishing, and it was actually because of Christians who understood this that we have enjoyed the relative prosperity of modern Western democracies. Yet some today are often tempted to turn to the state for the solution to every problem. The brilliant economist Thomas Sowell, he gives some wise counsel. He says that what is ominous is the ease with which some people go from saying that they don't like something to saying that the government should forbid it. When you go down that road, don't expect freedom to survive for very long, end quote. The promises from political elites that it could produce some sort of utopia if we only gave them enough power is a claim to bring in a false kingdom which is antithetical to the kingdom of God. And Sowell is actually insightful again here. He says that the fact that so many successful politicians are such shameless liars is not only a reflection on them, it is also a reflection on us. When the people want the impossible, only liars can satisfy. Now let's talk about how this impacts you and I, right? Let's talk about how is it, practically speaking, how should this proper biblical understanding of God's design for government impact us? I'm going to cover just four closing thoughts for us here. Firstly, we should understand that the only source of inalienable fundamental rights is going to be God. If the source of your rights is the government, then the government can take them away. They aren't inalienable. Instead, fundamental rights properly find their origin in our Creator. And government's role is simply to recognize those rights. They don't create those rights. They recognize the rights that have been given to us by God. And this is actually enshrined in many Western civil constitutions, probably most famously in the U.S. Bill of Rights, which opens off with this. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among those of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Now, to keep our countries free and to uphold human dignity and freedoms, we must recognize God as the only objective source of those things. Truly, every good and perfect gift comes down from above, James 1:17, even the gift of fundamental human rights. Audrey Rushduni says that this source of sovereignty is also the source of freedom. If sovereignty resides in God and is only held ministerially by men, then the basic responsibility of rulers and ruled is to God, who is also the source of freedom. But if sovereignty resides in the state, whether a monarchy or democracy, man has no appeal beyond the law of the state and no source of ethics apart from it. He is totally responsible to that order and has only those rights which the state chooses to confer upon him. Secondly, this, limited government. We have to understand this. Jesus said that we're to give to Caesar that which belongs to him and to give to God, not to Caesar, the things that belong to God. And conversely, this implies that Caesar shouldn't take the things that don't belong to him, because theft is theft even when it's done by the state. Thus, the government may not take on authority that properly belongs to God, or by extension to the church or any other sphere. Only God is totally sovereign, and only God can command obedience to his law in all spheres. This insight is something that Christianity brought to the world. Actually, Glenn Sunshine, in his book Slaying Leviathan, which is a really great book you should check out, it gives a little bit of a history of this thought of Christian thought and government. He notes this, that this was a groundbreaking idea, right? The insight that it's not the state, but only God who is sovereign. He says that up to the Edict of Milan, governments were essentially totalitarian. They claimed authority over every area of life, even supervising religious belief and practice, and determining which religions would be accepted and which would not. Thus, if we desire to keep our lands glorious and free and prosperous, we must continue to advocate for government limited according to God's design. Thirdly, we need civil re-engagement by Christians. George Washington, in his farewell address, said, quote, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." We need Christians to be engaged in civic and political life. Not everyone is called to be a politician, but we can all make informed votes. We can all write our local representatives about concerns and about concerning bills and laws being passed. We can all advocate for just laws and pray for our leaders. That's hugely important. Pray for your leaders. We're actually commanded in scripture to do that. These are all ways that we can practically love our neighbors, because the more our societies are built upon God's righteous standards, the more it will be blessed by him. Dr. DeMar actually appropriately warns us. He says, quote, "The possibility of the rise of tyranny in a society is in direct proportion to the privatization of the Christian faith and the preoccupation with the irrelevancy of that faith to the larger society. Nazi Germany was no fluke. It can happen again. It can happen here." I think he's right. We must re-engage with public life in whatever spheres of influence God has put you in to be salt and light. We must confront systemic unbelief with systemic belief by expounding and living out the beautiful vision of a Christian world and life view for a watching world to see. How will we do that? Well, for example, every Christian family and church is actually a microcosm of what godly government and flourishing in community should look like. As Professor John M. Frame notes, he says, quote, "In the modern world, then, each Christian is a citizen of two nations, an earthly nation like France, England, or the USA, and a heavenly nation," see Ephesians 2:6, "not of this world," and John 8:36, right? The church. "Though we belong entirely to Christ, we do not on that account renounce our citizenship in the earthly nations any more than we leave our earthly families. Indeed, we seek to be good citizens, for those earthly nations themselves and their rulers receive their authority from God." Thus, we Christians are citizens of two realms, the earthly and the spiritual. Such dual citizenship includes rights and responsibilities in both spheres. So we're not actually allowed to retreat into our pietistic huddles, waiting for Jesus to beam us up out of here. Our Lord has given us marching orders and a mission to disciple the nations and to be salt and light in the societies that he's placed us. Fourthly, this, and to close off, you need to understand bottom-up instead of top-down change. Okay? Really important. Bottom-up instead of top-down change. The American founders actually recognized that the democratic republic system of governance that they had created, or that they were creating, was one that could only work and be maintained in a society with a virtuous citizenry. John Adams actually said in his to the Massachusetts militia in 1798 that, quote, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Avarice and ambition and revenge or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our constitution as a whale goes through a net. Our constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." That's such a good quote, because that's exactly what's happened in our Western societies. You see, to give freedom to undisciplined men is to give them license for multiplied sin. Dr. Damar again is very particularly insightful here. He says, quote, "As people govern themselves, so goes the government of the nation. In the end, we get the government that we vote for. All governments, family, church, and civil, have as their foundation the self-governing character of individuals. As the people govern themselves, good or bad, so goes the family, the church, business, medicine, science, education, truth-telling in journalism and politics. The government at the top reflects the government at the bottom, that is, self-government. The more self-government becomes a problem, the greater the power and authority of the civil government." You see, the more that individuals lack self-government, the more that they're going to look to this all-powerful nanny state to be like a surrogate parent to them, providing and protecting and telling them what to do and think. That's exactly what's going on today. Those who lack self-government will always elect leaders who promise them relief from the consequences of their own sin and poor choices. But of course, that relief always ends up in just being more tyranny. Therefore, if you want to change a nation, the place to start is with individuals in self-government, with you and me, and with taking personal responsibility. Change will not be realized from a top-down, right? Until there is a good, righteous self-government under God at the bottom, we get the civil government that we deserve. In 1682, William Penn actually wrote this. He said, quote, "Let men be good, and the government cannot be bad. If it be ill, they will cure it. But if men be bad, let the government be never so good, they will endeavor to warp and spoil it to their turn." Huh. That's some good insight. The truth is that there's no salvation in politics. No governing document or set of politicians can create freedom, stability, or security by compulsion for people to comply to a set of ideals. Even the best of political intentions will be thwarted by the will of the people. Thus, though we should be involved as Christians in the upper levels of civil government and in voting and all these things, true lasting change is only going to happen from the bottom up. We must aim at reforming the individual, the family, and the church, and then civil government in that order. The only thing which can reform the individual from the inside out and produce lasting change is actually a love of God's law, which is only produced through the gospel. Therefore, our people and churches have to be committed to a passionate, unapologetic, and open gospel proclamation of salvation in Christ alone, repentance from sin, and self-denying, cross-bearing in a wholehearted following after Jesus. You see, pastors and churches and church leaders must be able to disciple people in a complete world and life view, including, but not limited to, a beautiful vision of God's design for societal flourishing and freedom as a powerful apologetic against the secular lies of today. So it starts with you and me. It starts with at the bottom and the gospel being central to it all. That's what's going to bring true and lasting change. Well, I hope that you've enjoyed today's episode and it's given you some points to think about. You can check out the written version of this episode on the blog. The link will be in the show notes. And until next time, soli Deo Gloria.
Thanks for listening to the Theotivity podcast. If you found this content helpful or edifying, please leave a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, follow us on social media and consider sharing this episode to help Theotivity reach others as well. Check out theotivity.com for resources, info on how to support, and subscribe to our monthly newsletter to stay up to date on all the latest content. Until next time, live and create to the glory of God.